Okay. So this afternoon, thank you for coming and not bailing out and going to lunch. I'm going to be talking about network insights into implementing peer-based HIV prevention for homeless youth. And these are some of my collaborators, and Amanda actually has slogged through these data on my behalf for about 18 months now. So this is, in some ways, this is the main result. Oh, I have nothing shady going on. These are the main results of an NIMH-funded longitudinal study of social networks of homeless youth, which I started back in 2011. And you're actually the guinea pigs who get to see this. This is the first time I've presented these results in public, so we'll see how well I do. It's important to understand HIV risk is a huge problem for homeless youth, and that there are a lot of homeless youth in the United States. 1.6 million is the estimate. The estimates are old. The estimates probably are undercounts. Prevalence rates have been reported as high as 11.5%. Again, the prevalence rates are old. But clear in the research on homeless youth is that there's an enormous amount of HIV risk-taking behaviors going on among these youth, and we also know that there's a lot of homeless youth who are seeking HIV treatment, so that clearly there's a connection that's going on here. And there's very few HIV prevention interventions that have actually been developed or tested for homeless youth. So there's a great desire to have more, better HIV prevention interventions. And one of the issues that has really come up in the last few years, both in academic literature and also amongst folks from community-based organizations that I've spent time talking with, is the desire to do peer-based prevention. If any of you work with homeless youth, you know that they're very disconnected from adults, and they're primarily connected to one another. So there's a sort of an intuitive appeal around doing peer-based prevention. And in fact, Mary Jane Rothrum Boris and her collaborator Elizabeth Arnold wrote a paper that was a review of HIV prevention interventions for homeless youth back in 2009 and said, you know, the next thing we ought to do is a peer-based prevention. I've been kind of working along that line for a while now. Hank Green and colleagues at RAND published a paper about a year ago where they said, you know, we really think these popular opinion leader interventions would be a great thing to do for homeless youth. I and Harmony Rhodes, my colleague, she and I wrote a rebuttal to them saying, I don't know, there's a lot of things we got to work out. And so this study that I'm going to be sharing with you now is kind of trying to think very carefully about what can we learn from a really detailed understanding of the social networks of homeless youth? What can we learn about what may be our implementation challenges if we're to launch a popular opinion leader model? So do most of you out there know how the popular opinion leader model works? Yes, no? Okay, I'm getting half nods, so I'll give it a quick version. The idea is you find a target population that's at high risk for HIV/AIDS. You find the most popular people in that community. You train them to be the disseminators of norm-changing information, particularly around condom use and HIV testing, and you send them back out into the community to share, to spread these messages, and hopefully their friends will take up these messages, and their friends will take up these messages, and their friends will take up these messages, and soon you'll have a permutation and a diffusion of positive, HIV prevention behaviors in that population. These models are predicated on a couple of things. One, that your population is actually connected to each other. Okay, so that's one of the things that I'm going to be looking at here. The second is that there's some amount of stability over time so that people have relationships with one another that are enduring long enough that they can have meaningful enough relationships with one another to maybe impart norm-changing information to one another. That's another assumption. And then the third is really that people will talk about condoms and HIV testing with their peers. And I think that although these models are predicated on the notion that we can train people to do that communication, I think it's important for us to look at a population and see how much is that kind of dialogue actually going on across people's social ties to begin with, so that we can get a sense of how hard or easy is this maybe going to be to get this going. So that's what I'm going to be looking at today. The way that we did this was actually the problem is more complicated, I think, than the solution is in some ways. So homeless youth are a very difficult population to look at when you're thinking about doing a population-level social network study. And the reason for that is that essentially new kids come into the population every day, and some kids move out of the population every day. And so it's what network researchers refer to as an unbounded population, or social work researchers talk about as an open system. So one of the things that you need to do if you want to study one of these systems is you need to create some sort of artificial boundary around that system. So what we decided to do was to use people's attendance at drop-in agencies as a way of bounding, kind of creating an organizational boundary around a group that doesn't really have an organizational affiliation. So drop-in centers are places typically where homeless youth go to get food, clothing, some case management, but they're really low barrier services for homeless youth. You have a lot of young people who are actively sleeping under bridges or on the beaches, who are going into these centers, and you also have young people who are in transitional living programs or have even found some level of stability in their housing, as well as couch surfers. So you have the full kind of spectrum of homeless youth represented at these centers. And they tend to be a hub of activity for homeless youth street culture. So what we decided to do was something relatively simple, which was go to a drop-in center, actually in this case two different drop-in centers, for a month and ask every single young person who walked through the door if they wanted to be a part of our study. And if they said yes, then we would recruit them into our study. And so we had two recruiters who would screen all of the youth so that we didn't, and this was not two recruiters who took turns every day. This is one person administered the self-interview survey, and the other person actually did the act of recruiting. So we had two people that were essentially checking to make sure that homeless youth weren't doing the survey twice during this month. And there were two parts to the survey. One was an audio CASI interview so that we got the risk behaviors and their demographic information with a self-interview. And then we also had an iPad app that we developed to collect their social network interview data, which looked something like this. So what we did was, through a bunch of pre-testing in the years before, we developed a name generator, is what social network researchers call it, but it's basically we asked them to describe the people that they've been communicating with over the last month, and that those could be people that they talked to online, they could talk to on the phone, they could talk to in person, and then we had about 17 prompts that followed this to ask them to delineate these networks. So how about friends, how about family, how about case managers, how about shop owners, how about your baby mom or your baby daddy, how about people you're hooking up with. I mean, so we had things that were in their language that they had helped us develop. And what we would do is that they would delineate these folks, and we asked for some key pieces of identifying information. So we asked them to name the names, the first and last names of their contacts, the gender, the race, the approximate age, and visible tattoos of those folks. And the reason that we did that is that what we wanted to do was take what people refer to as egocentric data, which is this. Okay. So each young person told us about their network of ties, which could, so if this red person is the central person who we're interviewing, then they might talk about some of their friends from home, these people in yellow, family members, these people in green, maybe a case manager, who's this person in orange, and then four other young people who are also part of the street network. And so what we tried to do with this identifying information was link the people who this young person talked about in the sample. And so what we did is we did this with everyone, so we're essentially we're linking up their networks together. And essentially, we're, at least for the sake of the analysis that I'm looking at now, we're cutting out everyone who's not part of that street network. So we're not looking, at least for these analyses, we're not looking at friends and family from home. We're just looking at the street networks. I will give you a little bit of the demographics. So we did three waves of data collection. We went once every 6 months and repeated this. And this is a panel survey. Right? We're not longitudinally tracking the same group of homeless young people for a year. What we did was we went to these sites to sample these open systems once every 6 months. Because one of the questions that we really want to know is, how stable is this population? So wave one, wave two, wave three, you can see for both network one and network two, predominantly male. Sexual orientation, primarily heterosexual identifying, although certainly there are LGBT folks in this population. When you look at the racial demographics, our two networks are somewhat different. In the one network, which we collected in Hollywood, it is the majority or the largest single minority is African American youth, whereas on the beaches in Venice Beach, which is where we collected this other network, it's primarily white youth. So just to give you a sense of HIV risk-taking behaviors to kind of place this in context, this is the percentage of youth reporting having had unprotected either anal or vaginal sex at their last sexual encounter. And you can see that it is about half or more than half of those young people across each wave. So it's a pretty consistent high unprotected sex reporting. When we look at HIV testing over the last 6 months, again, you can see some pretty big differences between these two different sites. So within Hollywood, where there's a much better interconnected set of services, HIV testing was much more common, and I think is a reflection of the service environment, whereas along the beaches, where there's a relative lack of services, there was less HIV testing. Okay, so now to the questions at hand. So how interconnected are these youth? So this is Network One, the first time we went and visited it, and this overall structure is going to be repeated 5 times. And essentially what I want to point out by this structure is a couple of features. First, about half of the youth are in this large interconnected sort of spider web here. So this is the kind of structure that you think of diffusion of innovations model or a popular behavior model would work pretty well in this. Even if you're one of the people out here, after a couple of steps, you're going to get reached by the folks that are more popular. But we also have about 20% of the youth reporting that they're either in dyads or triads or this one little small five-person network. So we've got a bunch of people that are, you know, they're connected to folks, but those folks aren't really connected to anybody else. And I think most alarming for me in terms of thinking about HIV prevention for the popular behavior model are all these people on the side. So those are about a third of the population that we sampled had no other connections to homeless youth on the street. So you have to understand that this is the way that we asked for this information was, who is it that you're communicating with in the last month? So really what this is reflective of is not that they don't necessarily know these other kids on the street. I mean, I would watch them as they came into the agency, be like, sup, and like move on to the next kid. So they knew each other, and they knew how to sort of socially interact with one another so as not to get beat up, but they don't have meaningful social exchanges with one another. Which I think is going to be a problem if we're going to talk about asking young people to talk about condom use and HIV testing across these, you know, kind of head nodding kind of relationships. So you can see wave two, even though, and this is it's called a spring and better routine. Essentially what it does, it's an algorithm that pulls people with shared ties close together, pushes people with a lack of shared ties further apart. It's really more of a qualitative way of thinking about social network data, even though it's built on a mathematical algorithm. But what you can see here is this consistency in the terms of this large interconnected structure with the small subnetworks and then the large number of isolates. Happens again in wave three. Network two, this is along the beaches. Again, it's a smaller network, but it's manifesting the same basic structure across the waves. Okay, so I'm going to skip because I put these into the wrong order. Where is it? Here. Okay. So what I'm really interested in is the stability over time. And this is something that poor Amanda slogged through with me for a long time. One of the key questions is, well, how stable is this network? And so what this data shows you here is that within the first network, the new respondents are blue, the repeat respondents are red. So from wave one to wave two, we had about a 56% change in the population. And then from wave two to wave three, it was a 58% change. In the second network, it's even more extreme than that. We had 82% were new participants in wave two, and 86% were new participants from wave two to wave three. So there's a lot of instability in these networks. That doesn't mean that a popular opinion leader model is impossible, but I think we're going to have to be thinking about the fact that over the course of 6 months, particularly in that one network, you're having an almost entire replacement of that population of youth. So even though the structure of the network looks sort of the same from wave to wave, it's made up of different young people, so we're going to have to be retraining and training new people to be our opinion leaders over time. Okay, so now the last question that I'm really interested in, 2 minutes, great, I can do it, is who are they talking to about stuff? So red lines are sex partners, green lines are people that they consider friends, gray lines are just folks that they nominated as being part of their communication networks, but that they don't consider to be either a friend or a sex partner. And the issue here is not just that, not surprisingly, who do they talk to about condoms is a small subset of that larger network, but it's a very specific subset of that larger network, which is primarily focused on their sex partners. So of the small number of ties where there is this kind of communication, about half of it, so it's 50% of sex partners are getting talked to about condoms, but only about a third of friends or acquaintances. And that's similar results, although even fewer friends and acquaintances in the more unstable network were being talked to. And then the same thing can be said of when you're talking about HIV testing. Again, partners, sex partners, you're having this communication with, but not friends as much, nor nearly acquaintances. So I think what we need to be thinking about with this last bit of data is not that we can't train homeless youth to maybe have these conversations, but we have to understand where they're having these conversations, and it's with their sex partners. And so we're going to have to work very hard to get them to talk to their friends, even harder to get them to talk to their acquaintances, and even harder still to get them to talk to these young people that they don't really consider to be part of their social exchange networks to begin with. Self-report data is always a problem. We've got these two populations in Venice and Hollywood, so the generalizability, this is certainly something that we need to call into question. And I think that we can probably run these opinion leader models and or SHIELD, which is another variant on this, but I think we're going to have to think very hard about these implementation challenges. So thanks a lot.